Retro.
Go.
Fido.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the March 11th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Thanks for joining us today, and well, despite losing 1 hour of sleep this morning, as we talk about our nation's space program during the next hour, I hope you will find it interesting enough to keep you from napping. I certainly promise not to fall asleep at the helm as we talk today about NASA's Orion spacecraft with our special guest Jules Schneider from Lockheed Martin. Now, unless SpaceX beats them to the punch with their Dragon spacecraft, Orion's going to be the next U.S. spacecraft that our NASA astronauts will be flying in, not only into Earth orbit and back, but perhaps back to the moon, maybe farther. We'll have to find out if Orion has the right stuff for going out to the asteroids or maybe even Mars. In any case, I do have a bunch of questions. I hope you do, too. You're welcome to join in on our conversation today by asking a question or making a comment about anything having to do with our space program. Either way, I'd love to have you join me on the air and talk space together. Give me a call anytime during the program now, 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us something by email, the address we're monitoring all the time here in the studio is spacetalking@aol.com. And without further ado, today, now, it's time for our weekly broadcast blog, which we call Orbital Inclinations. Well, this week I don't really have an opinion to share so much as I have some good news and some bad news to tell you. First, the good news. If you listened to last week's program on the Kepler mission to look for other planets in our galaxy, you remember what a truly great mission this is and the exciting results that they've obtained during the past years that the telescope has been in space. So far, Kepler has discovered 61 confirmed planets and cataloged more than 2,300 candidate planets. And for this, the Space Foundation, one of my former employers, is recognizing the Kepler team with this year's Jack Swigert Award for Space Exploration. Now, this is an extremely prestigious honor, in case you've never heard of it, named for the Apollo 13 astronaut who was eventually elected to Congress from Colorado, where the Space Foundation is headquartered, but unfortunately died of cancer in 1982 before he could assume office. So with that award, the Kepler team will be honored with it during the opening ceremony of the 28th National Space Symposium at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, which begins on April 16th, the biggest gathering of space folks from all walks of space life. Every year, about 8,000, 9,000 people expected. So, anyway, congratulations to my guest last week, William Borucki, and all of his fellow members of the Kepler team, who, by the way, also was honored this past week with the Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine's 2012 Laureate Award for Space. So they're doing outstanding work, and congratulations to them. By the way, if you missed the Space Talk program about Kepler last week, you can still download a podcast of the show by going to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link to the Space Talk archive. Now, as for the bad news, it is an unfortunate reality that as the years go by, we naturally have to say goodbye to more and more of the great pioneers who were responsible for so many historic achievements during those early days of our space program. For example, a couple of weeks ago, we lost Tal Webb, who was a widely respected and admired mechanical engineer who worked as a contractor on every NASA manned program from Project Mercury up through and including the space shuttle, retiring as a senior manager at United Space Alliance. So profound is his influence that the Canaveral section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers has an award named for him that's very prestigious and sought after. And although I did shake hands with him a few times, I must admit I never did get to know him well. but it says something about the importance of the man that the news of his passing raced through the local space community here, and everybody was talking about it. But hitting a little closer to home, at least for me, was the news that David Parrish had passed away this week. Now, if you're wondering who he was, let me tell you a little bit about him. Dave was a retired colonel in the Air Force who, from 1969 to 1972, served as commander of the 6555th Aerospace Test Group out of Patrick Air Force Base, which prepared Atlas and Titan missiles for launch from the Eastern Test Range. Now, actually, the 6555th went by a variety of names throughout its history, but it was the group that got things done, eventually for the Eastern Space and Missile Center, and then later, under a different name, for what we now know today as the 45th Space Wing. Now, Dave was here through it all, eventually working as a program manager for the Shuttle Payloads Operations Contract, which was an Air Force contract at Cape Canaveral, responsible for preparing Department of Defense payloads for launch on the space shuttle. Now, after retiring, Dave became involved with the Air Force Space and Missile Museum as a volunteer and as a member of the Air Force Space and Missile Museum Foundation Board of Directors, and took it upon himself there to manage the, well, the little gift shop we have out at the museum at Launch Complex 26. That's the site of the launch of Explorer 1, our nation's first satellite in orbit. Now, for the past decade or so, I have been involved with the Museum Foundation and currently am its secretary of the board. And one day on this show, we'll have to have a long talk about the Missile Museum and all the cool things that are out there to see and do. But one of my early duties, back when General Jimmy Morrell was the head of the foundation, was to assist Dave in managing the gift shop, as it was getting more and more difficult for him to do the job, especially as we sought to modernize the gift shop with the computerized inventory system and cash register. Now, to be honest, there were times when he and I didn't agree on the way to do some things. I was the young whippersnapper, and he was the old dog who didn't want to learn new tricks. But what was great about him was his absolute pure desire and drive to make that gift shop, and therefore the museum itself, the best it could possibly be. And when we got together out there and we were finished with whatever business we had, he would tell me stories about the missile or this one or that rocket, and what it was like to be a part of those incredible times back then in the heydays of Cape Canaveral. When he finally gave up the reins of the gift shop, the foundation board and the volunteers presented him with an engraved trophy, which I was honored to be the one to have designed and procured. And now today, thanks in large part and in so many ways to Dave's work and his legacy, we not only have a thriving gift shop at Complex 26 that supports the museum activities, but we also got a pretty decent gift shop at our new History Center, located outside the south gate of Cape Canaveral at the end of 401, and that, of course, ably managed by our foundation's own Sharon Rodriguez and Marianne Edwards. So, to David Parrish's wife, Martha, his five children, 12 grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren, we send our condolences, prayers, and thanks for the Colonel's contributions in enabling us to continue the story of the history of launch operations at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. If you happen to be interested, services for Dave will be tomorrow, Monday, 10:30 a.m. at Faith Vieira Lutheran Church, and following that will be the burial at the Florida National Cemetery in Bushnell with full military honors. Godspeed, David Parrish. You were a truly steely-eyed missile man, and you will be missed. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Now, as we get ready for our first break, the phone line's still open for your calls, your questions, your comments about anything having to do with our space program. Give us a call at 321-768-1240. Or send an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Now, when we come back, Jules Schneider from Lockheed Martin will join us to talk about NASA's Orion spacecraft, the multi-purpose crew vehicle. You don't want to miss it. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. With everything you need to know program. Here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. Now at its new time slot of 3 p.m. every Sunday, right here on WMMB. Again, 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. Please do give us a call. Let us know you're out there. Send us an email if you want, spacetalking@aol.com. Well, to get into today's topic, let me remind you that back in 2004, President Bush announced the Vision for Space Exploration, which included a plan for finishing the space station, retiring the space shuttle, building a new rocket, and replacement for the shuttle, all with the goal of going back to the moon and eventually on to Mars. The program became known as Constellation. Well, for reasons I might share with you another time, it's not what you think. And very soon, the rockets that would be used were named Ares, and the spacecraft that would be built to replace our space shuttle's ability to carry astronauts into and out of Earth orbit was called Orion. Well, then, after promising something else in a campaign stop on the Space Coast, after being elected, President Obama sought fit to kill Constellation, including Orion. The backlash in the space community was great enough such that the president decided to come to the Kennedy Space Center, and here he announced that, in fact, Orion would continue on in some fashion. Now, you can make your own political judgments about the president and his space policy. We're not necessarily going to delve into that any further today. Frankly, I'm just glad that Orion is still with us. And it is real, and one day, I hope sooner than later, it will carry our astronauts to Earth orbit and beyond. Now, to hear today to talk with us about Orion from the perspective of the spacecraft itself and what's being done here at the Kennedy Space Center by Lockheed Martin is the company's senior manager for Orion Assembly, Integration, and Production at KSC, Jules Schneider. Jules, welcome to the program today.
Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me here.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Well, we're talking Orion. You got your Orion shirt on. I have my Orion patch hanging on the wall back home. We're pretty excited it's still here. Let's start by, first of all, well, let's get to know you a little bit better. Tell us about your background, where you come from, and, you know, why space for you?
Sure. Well, I grew up in New Orleans, attended college there and got a degree in engineering. And upon graduation, hired in with Martin Marietta at the time, mm-hmm. who was the prime contractor for the external tank program
right.
down at the Michoud facility down there.
Okay.
Spent 20 years at that facility working on various programs, worked on the external tank, worked on X-33. Don't know if you remember that
one. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Worked on X-38. The crew return vehicle, worked on a couple of other programs, and then worked on the Orion proposal for mm-hmm. Lockheed Martin. And upon winning that, transferred down to KSC to set up the manufacturing facility that we have today in the ONC building.
So now you're in New Orleans, so we're going to bypass, since it's not football season, the whole New Orleans Saints, Minnesota Vikings, Brett Favre bounty thing, right? We were discussing that earlier. It's not a good issue between the two of us.
No, not at the moment.
Not at the moment. We'll see how it resolves by this fall. But you were at Michoud. When did you come here to KSC?
Right after it was announced that Lockheed Martin had won Orion, which I believe was in August of 06. It was announced late August. So
you were there for Katrina?
Yes. Yes, I was there for Katrina.
Wow. How long after Katrina before you came here?
About a year. I think Katrina was in August of 05, if I remember correctly.
And wow. Yeah. So I didn't know that about you. So, okay. We could do a whole program here right now
and
forget about Orion. But let me ask you real quick, because I got to, because we all live among hurricanes here. One of the untold, spectacular stories of the history of the space program, and I swear there's a book and a movie that has to be made someday about this, is how your team at Michoud basically kept the space shuttle program going after Katrina. I mean, the families living in the hangars. I mean,
right.
Tell us just briefly a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm surprised you know about it, because it's not that widely known out there that there was a ride-out crew at Michoud that kept basically the plant alive during and after the storm. You couldn't get to the facility except by helicopter after the storm.
Yeah.
And they were moving people in and supplies in via the Stennis Center in Mississippi, which got damaged, but not nearly as heavily as Michoud. And that team did indeed save the factory and allowed it to survive and to continue production of the tank, which without, obviously, you couldn't launch the space shuttle.
And you're doing that. I mean, a lot of us who lived through hurricanes here, I mean, I'm not even sure we can relate to what you went through. I mean, you were living at the place. Your families were living there. Like I say, you couldn't get around, and yet the concentration, while your homes are in the water and destroyed and your lives are basically in bad shape, you're still pumping out these tanks. And I don't think you missed a beat. I don't think we ever delayed a launch because of a missed delivery, as I recall.
No, and that's one of Lockheed Martin's bright spots is they never did delay a launch in the entire shuttle program due to an external tank issue with delivery.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're going to talk later. We'll write the book together maybe.
Okay.
But let's talk about Orion. Tell us about Orion. First of all, what is it? What's its purpose? Give us some of the basic facts about this spacecraft.
Well, as you mentioned, it was initially part of the Constellation program. And in Constellation, its initial mission was to ferry astronauts to the International Space Station. Once the Obama administration decided to change that and we continued on as MPCV, as you mentioned earlier, our mission really now is just exploration. So we don't have a low Earth orbit station resupply mission or requirement. Today our requirement is just exploration, which is beyond low Earth orbit.
Now, but that means that Orion, I mean, the mission scenario still is you still go into low Earth orbit and essentially park there and then do something and then move on from there. But your job is not to go back and forth from the station.
That's correct.
You have that capability, but you don't – or even you even have that capability.
It's
you have
not,
a docking mechanism.
We have a docking mechanism. It's not a requirement today for us to go to the space station like it was under Constellation.
Okay.
I don't think it would be much of a reach for us to do that.
Sure, sure.
But that is not part of our current requirement set.
We'll talk about some specifics of the Orion compared to Apollo in a little bit, but I'm curious about, you know, first of all, there's all this talk about launch vehicles, and right now as you sit, do you even, quote-unquote, care about who you're going to ride into orbit on? Does it matter to you in terms of the design and production of the vehicle, whether it's an Atlas V or a Falcon 9 or something, some SLS vehicle to come?
Only from a technical standpoint. Obviously, the environments that are imparted on the spacecraft or the payload, pretty much where a payload by the launch vehicle is obviously from a technical standpoint.
Yeah.
We have to be able to deal with that. But other than that, no, we really don't. You may have heard that we have a test flight scheduled for 2014.
Which was just announced.
Right. And that's going up on a Delta 4.
Delta 4. Right. Unmanned, of course.
Yes, unmanned.
Right now, we're hoping that spacecraft isn't here yet, is it?
No, but it will be very soon, and I'm glad you asked that question because a lot of people don't realize that in just a couple of months, in May, in fact, the primary structure for that vehicle will arrive at the ONC building from the Michoud facility.
Okay.
That's where the structure is being built for the crew module.
Okay.
And we'll finish the structural build of it here and then do some structural testing. And then we'll get into the outfitting of the crew module.
Outfitting assembly here,
right.
Which, again, I want to ask a little bit more about in a minute. So this mission then on the Delta IV launches into an extended orbit and slams it back through the atmosphere, as I recall.
Right, right. The mission really does several things, but one of the main objectives is to simulate the reentry environments from an exploration mission versus a low Earth orbit reentry.
It's a lot hotter. People don't remember, like, when Apollo came back from the moon, once you burned out of the moon orbit and came back trans-Earth, you didn't go back into low Earth orbit again, circle a few times, and gently come down. I mean, you went right back down and hit that atmosphere super hard, super fast.
Yeah, it's a hotter, faster reentry than a LEO reentry. And then, again, we also have to land under parachutes.
Yeah.
So we want to obviously, that's one of the other main objectives of this flight test coming up is to prove out all of the landing systems.
And we're in water landing now?
Yes, water landing, Pacific Ocean off the coast of Southern California.
And is that pretty much set? I remember there was a lot of controversy back in the Constellation Day. I shouldn't say controversy, but a lot of back and forth, whether it was water, land, Utah, or the Pacific.
Right. When we first won, our proposal was to land on land.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept that in our plans for I don't know how long it was until NASA and us came got together and decided to move it offshore into the water.
When I got to tell you real quick, when the announcement was made, and of course there were stories various posted online. Of course, you always see these comments at the end of stories, you know, from these people who just think they're rocket scientists. And so there was a story about how Orion's going to be test flown and come back like in Apollo, only the temperature would be 6,000 degrees hotter than a reentry for the space shuttle. Okay, and that's basically true. Basically true. That there's a lot hotter reentry temperatures than the shuttle. But the commenter said, "Boy, that's incredible. Proof once again that there's global warming because the Earth is that much hotter than it was back in the 1960s for this ship coming through than compared to right now." So anyway, totally got off base. I think it's great that it's going to be flying very soon. We're going to talk more about Orion and related to Apollo and all that kind of stuff. But for now, we're going to take our pause, our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour as we take this break, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And we're back with more about Orion with Jules Schneider. Your call is always welcome, 321-768-1240. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240.
Welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. As you heard, phone lines open for your contributions to the conversation we're having today about the Orion spacecraft with Jules Schneider from Lockheed Martin. Again, give us a call, 321-768-1240, or send an email with your question or comments to spacetalking@aol.com. By the way, before we continue, I want to give a quick shout-out to everyone who produces the Tycho Warbird Air Show. The annual air show up at the Tycho Airport, Space Coast Executive Airport now. I guess we've been around for a while. We used to call it Tycho. It's in its final day today. It looks like the weather is going to cooperate this afternoon. It was a little nasty this morning. I hope everything stayed clear. If you happen to be out there listening in to the show while watching the festivities in the sky, give us a call. Let us know what's going on up there. It's a great show. Hey, before we get back to Jules, we do have our first – this is my first caller post-hospital stay in the last 4 weeks. Barry from Palm Bay, congratulations. You're the number one guy. You got a question for our guest about space travel. Welcome to the program, Barry.
Yes, Jim, thank you, and welcome back to the airwaves of the WMB. We're happy to have you back.
Good, thanks. What's up?
Mr. Schneider, I'd like to ask you maybe a silly question, but you're very well qualified to answer it, I'm sure. You know, I'm a mild Star Trek fan, and I can remember when it first started and you saw all these guys running around with little communicators on their shoulders or on their shirts. And they say, wow, isn't that cool? And now all these years later, everybody has a Bluetooth in their ear. Lieutenant O'Hara used to have a little thing in her ear, and now we have it as well. I was wondering, you know, you see the Star Trek shows, and they don't blast off in a rocket from Earth. They go in a transporter up to a floating space station where the Star Trek ship is located. They transfer to that, and they fly off to some other solar system. Can you foresee or predict somewhere down the road, maybe 50 years, maybe 75 years, that we'll have something like that and we won't be stuck with having to get a solid rocket-fueled rocket to get us out from here to there?
Barry, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We'll get you the answer here. Okay, let's talk about it real quick, Jules. First of all, you a Star Trek fan?
Yes,
you know about
so.
All this stuff? So,
absolutely.
Okay. So the transporter, okay, not too soon.
Yeah, probably can't make any predictions on that one.
But you know what he's asking about, and it's funny, we were talking about it during the break, about what kind of a vehicle do you need to design certain capabilities. Do we need solids? Do we need liquids? When do we get the first, you know, single-staged orbit? When do we get the shuttlecraft, the Millennium Falcon? We just take off wherever we want, go into space, come back whenever, however we want.
Well, it's funny you should say that single stage to orbit, because that's right. I mentioned earlier X-33, which was single stage to orbit So never got to finish that job, but we actually were quite a ways along the way when it got canceled.
Pretty close, not quite there. A few some technical issues, I think, with the propellant tanks or something.
With the composite liquid hydrogen tanks.
But ultimately, it was funding and priorities and all of that.
Right. But the vehicle was about 80% built out in Palmdale. To the caller's question, obviously, anything that goes up in, if it gets to orbit and it comes from the Earth, then it's got to get up there, right?
Right.
So you're going to have to use some kind of mechanism. Today we use launch vehicles, obviously, to get it there.
With chemical propulsion, you know,
right.
And solids and liquid and all that.
Exactly.
So.
You know, you look at the space station, it's you could see that it could be a starting point. You could park a vehicle there potentially and head out from there, but you still have to get everything up there, right?
Yeah, the neat thing about low Earth orbit is I understand the physics and the gravity well that it's called. Every planet has a gravity well. The moon has a gravity well. Once you climb out of that well, you can go anywhere. It's like from flying from Melbourne to Atlanta. From Atlanta, you can get anywhere. So if you get to low Earth orbit, it's really quite easy, relatively speaking. Space flight's a tough business to get almost anywhere once you're there.
Well, the amount of energy, so the propulsion systems, right? Once you're out of the Earth's gravitational pull, then you don't need as much thrust, to get where you need to go. So that's why these interplanetary spacecrafts, their propulsion systems from a pounds of thrust are not very big, but certainly enough to get them to do what they need to do.
Last comment on this line. Of course, we all know if we're a Star Trek fan that 2063, the Vulcans come to land on Earth and we have first contact. I don't know if I'll make it. I don't know if you'll make it, but I keep telling my kids, keep your fingers crossed. We've only got another 50 years to go before warp drive. Let's talk about the Orion, and let's talk about the whole thing about Apollo. When people look at Orion spacecraft, one of the test articles was out at Space Coast Stadium. Bob Cabana got to throw the pitch. I didn't hear whether or not he actually made it over home plate, but I'm sure we can find that out. Yeah, you'd think he would. But it was out there in public. There's been one in the visitor complex for people to see. And when people look at it, my own family included, they see an Apollo capsule. And they say, oh, we already did this. After all these years, we haven't learned anything different. Why do we have to go back to the Apollo design? Nothing could be farther from the truth, isn't that right?
Well, obviously, it's a much more capable spacecraft. Just some simple things like it has a bathroom or a potty, if you will. it has a galley.
Right.
So, and Apollo had, I don't think the Apollo.
They didn't.
Capsule had either of those. And it, you know, its mission is a lot more, I'll say, the requirements, at least back in Constellation when we were going to the moon. I'll give you an example. The mission back then was four people to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
All four went down to the surface of the moon, so Orion had to stay in lunar orbit on its own autonomously for up to 90 days and then hook up with the lunar lander when it came back up and get back to Earth. So lots of, as you can imagine, I mean, where are we at 40, 50 years later, you know, the technology that you can put into it is obviously much more advanced.
Well, I think people are fooled by the shape, too.
Right.
And if you're going to design a spacecraft that goes out there and then comes back into the atmosphere the way it does, and you want to do some kind of what's called a lifting reentry where you've got some steering capability. It's not just a brick falling through the sky. In fact, I think it might even be more capable than the shuttle in terms of maneuvering through the atmosphere.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but you're right. I mean, and, you know, to the credit of the Apollo guys, they got it right with respect to the shape of that kind of a vehicle.
Yeah. But the point is the laws of physics haven't changed since the 1960s.
That's right.
So you're going to get this conical-shaped diamond or pyramid-shaped vehicle. But you talk about the differences. You know, we make a big point on the fact that my simplest digital watch has more electronic and computing capability than all of Apollo combined. You know, you're going to be flying this Orion spacecraft with what I'm going to assume are modern glass cockpits and computer capability. And in fact, I'll bet you the way the government works, it's already old compared to what's out on the streets at Best Buy.
Actually, I think our avionics suite is based off of it's Honeywell is our subcontractor helping us with the avionics. And I believe it's based on a 777
oh, really?
Avionics suite. So
it's pretty modern.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think they've already moved past. So now you have the 787. So to your point,
true.
It's still a generation.
Still a little behind.
Right.
But, you know,
right.
The funny thing about electronics was about space, and a lot of people don't understand this either, is, of course, the hard radiation environment
exactly
can mess up electronics so bad. And so one reason why sometimes you'd have these computers flying that seem like they're so ancient and slow compared to what we have at Best Buy is that when you go buy something at a big box store and take it home, everything's cool, but you don't have all this radiation bombarding. So if you're going to protect these chips from the radiation, what's called hardening the electronics, then you got to deal with some lead time and some kind of stuff.
Yeah. You have to qualify those components to those environments. And you bring up a good point, Jim. Low Earth orbit, you get some of that. But
right.
When you go out to some of these exploration destinations and you go through the Van Allen belt, et cetera,
beyond the protection of our magnetic field or whatever.
Right, the radiation exposure levels go up, and you're absolutely right. All of your components, including the people on board, have to be protected from that.
Which, of course, has been great news. Well, I don't know if it's great news, but it's been in the news this past week, of course, how this solar flare erupted, a giant solar flare, and happened to be pointed right at Earth. And we got bombarded by all this, these protons and neutrons or whatever hit us. I'm hearing auroras came down from the south or come from down the north, very far south. Satellite transmissions have been screwed up a little bit. There was somebody complaining how their audio kept dropping out of their cable, you know, and they think that might have been. So as protected as we are, is my point, here on Earth, you take the spacecraft out in this environment between Earth and Mars, this Orion spacecraft better have some pretty decent radiation shielding.
Right.
And it does.
Yes, it's funny you should ask that because Jay Barbary was in the facility on Thursday afternoon of this week, and we were giving him a tour, and he was asking questions about the radiation protection that Orion will provide for the astronauts.
He was on the show here when my return, well, my first live show back here a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about that, and he's been very interested in that, talking about the radiation shielding you need on the moon, for example,
right?
You know, and just how a little bit of dirt basically covers up what you need. And it's a huge issue. It's one of those issues that is one of the big long, quote unquote, long poles in the tent for humans going to Mars that we really haven't nailed down yet. There's a lot of theories, a lot of ways you could do it. You could, I understand, build a spacecraft and put a whole big, giant, huge water bag around it. But then how are you going to get that much water up, and how are you going to do
that?
That's
a bit
weight?
Heavy.
And that's a lot. That's a lot of weight. So,
right.
So as we talk about Orion 2 and the radiation, I'm curious, again, comparing it to Apollo. You know, Apollo, as I recall, mostly aluminum, metal, basically. Orion composites, man-made composites, or
it's a
combination?
Yeah. We try and target the composite applications where they fit best. We learned a lot, as you mentioned, on X-33 about where composites do work well and sometimes where they don't.
Yeah.
The primary structure for the crew module, the pressure vessel, if you will, where the astronauts will be on Orion, is aluminum-lithium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the welding technology is friction stir welding versus the traditional plasma arc welding.
And we're not going to give anybody a headache by trying to explain the difference between those two. But the friction stir welding, aluminum, lithium, big lessons learned from the external tank program.
Yes, yes. And that's why the guys at Michoud are the ones producing that.
Being involved.
Structure.
We're going to talk about what happens to the Orion spacecraft after it gets here to the Kennedy Space Center. As we take our final break of the day, we'll come back, talk some more about Orion, wrap it all up. And we'll take a look at our local launch forecast. For now, I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. First, with a quick reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. And if you're on Twitter, our hashtag is Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping for everything having to do with the program, just visit WMMBAM.com. Enter in keyword Space Talk, and you'll be right at our page. Before we continue talking about Orion with Jules Schneider from Lockheed Martin, we're going to take a moment here and do our weekly look at the local launch forecast. First of all, though it won't be launched from the Space Coast. Our Kennedy Space Center launch team will be traveling soon to the Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands to send a Pegasus-winged rocket on its way into orbit. The launch now set for March 22nd. It will be carrying NuSTAR, a NASA mission to study high-energy X-rays. And in fact, if they stay true to their schedule, the NuSTAR mission is having its flight readiness review today up at KSC. So we certainly will update you on the progress of launch plans next week's program, and we wish them good luck as they get ready to travel, safe travels to the other side of the planet. Meanwhile, the next launch from the Cape here is an Atlas V rocket, as we've been talking about. The mission remains targeted for April 27th with the launch window that extends from 3:08 to 5:08 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The United Launch Alliance shot is to carry another military communications satellite into orbit, this one called the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellite. So that's our launch forecast. Again, we'll keep you up to date on what's going on, let you know when you're supposed to go outside and look up and see something cool flying from the Space Coast. In our remaining moments here with Lockheed Martin's Jules Schneider, we're talking about the Orion spacecraft, the Multi-Purpose Crew Vehicle, NASA's latest, greatest acronym for this thing, but we'll keep calling it Orion and be excited. You know, really, the main reason why you're here, and of course, it's a shame we're spending this last segment on it, but is to talk about how this work is being done here at Kennedy Space Center. The fact that Orion is being assembled here is a historic change in the way KSC has operated and has been thought of in our space program, going way back to the very beginning of Kurt Debus and Wernher von Braun. Talk a little bit about the Orion and the work that's being done here.
Sure.
Which you're in charge of, by the way.
Traditionally, NASA would put out an RFP, and then there would be a competition.
Request for proposals.
Right, and they would